You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last week, the White House reported that in 2015, household incomes grew at the fastest rate on record and that the poverty rate fell faster than at any point since 1968. Yet despite that, homelessness remains a serious nationwide crisis. And although Mayor de Blasio says he's made fighting homelessness a priority, the Coalition for the Homeless notes that the situation in New York City has reached its highest levels since the Great Depression. How did we get this way? In his new book called Homelessness in New York City, Policymaking from Koch to de Blasio, Thomas J. Main, an associate professor at the Baruch School of Public Affairs, chronicles the history of modern homeless policies in New York City and attempts to explain this seemingly intractable issue. It's published by NYU Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Main to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
As of this month, what's the number of homeless people living in New York? Do we know?
Well, let's see. I think the shelter census, the Department of Homeless Services shelter census, is a little over 60,000 people. So it's at an all-time high.
And that would be considered a larger number relative to the population of the city, which has also grown in recent years.
Right. Well, that's, you know, I'm not sure what's happened to the ratio over time. You make a good point. I think there are, let's see, how many housing units are there in the city? Something like 3 million. So in a certain sense, it's a small problem, quote unquote, relative to the size of the housing stock, but it involves a lot of suffering and, you know, and of course the plight of the people who are very badly off is particularly important.
How does it compare to other cities in the United States?
I think we have the largest homeless population, with the possible exception of Los Angeles. But, you know, I have to confess.
Although San Francisco always seems to be the place that people mention,
yes,
because the homeless seem to be rather aggressive there.
Yes. You know, I have to confess, I've spent all my time looking at homeless policy in New York City because I'm interested in New York City politics. I really can't say very much about what goes on in the rest of the country.
And I imagine there are a lot of difficulties in collecting data on homeless populations.
Yes, but, you know, we're getting better. I mean, I remember when I started following this issue back in the early 80s, right, just coming up with accurate estimates of how many homeless people there were on the street was, you know, very difficult. And there was a big debate about whether it was possible at all. I think a lot more data is available these days.
How is homelessness technically or legally defined?
Well, I suppose you could think of it in this way. I would say if you present yourself at in New York City and you request a shelter under the Callahan versus Carey consent decree, it's pretty close to saying anybody who asks for it gets it. I think you have to appear to be eligible for public assistance. And in homeless families, you have to demonstrate that you have no other place to go.
But aren't there some people who've said they prefer living on the streets to going to the shelters?
Well,
so are they counted?
Oh, yes. Yes, they would count. So if you put it this way, if you're living on the street or you're in the shelter system, you're homeless.
What qualifies a person or family for emergency housing that's provided by the city?
Well, let's see. I think that, as I said, with homeless individuals, it's pretty close to, you know, on demand. Mm-hmm. With homeless families, you have to go through an intake process. The city has the right to inquire as to whether you have no other place to live. And so there's a long intake process that you have to go through. It was more elaborate under Bloomberg. I believe it's been cut back and it's loosened up a little bit under de Blasio. But you have to get yourself through that eligibility process.
And can't it be complicated? For example, somebody might have a place to go, but those people don't want them there. And the city might see that as their home, and they might feel that it isn't their home.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a it's a eligibility determination is very tough, and you do have situations where someone says, I can't return to a particular apartment, and then the city investigates and says, gee, we think you could, right? And there's dispute back and forth, and there's elaborate series of regulations from the state about what the obligations of the city and the applicant are. And my understanding is there may have been a bit of a loosening. I believe applicants are cut a little more slack now than they used to be, but you can't just waltz in the family system.
In some cases, they've been thrown out. In other cases, people are escaping abuse.
Yes.
You write that there are social scientists who are serious about creating conditions to solve homelessness. Is that theoretically possible?
Well, let's see. You know, even at the height of the 60s booming economy, you still had the Bowery. And back then in those days, in the 60s, when people talked about homelessness, they meant mostly Bowery drunks.
They called them Bowery bums.
Bowery bums, was one term. So even in that situation, you had people who were living on the street. So maybe, you know, getting down to literal zero people on the street is pretty tough. However, I think, you know, given that we've got a census now of 60,000 homeless individuals plus about, 5,000 people on the street, we could be doing better.
Wouldn't it involve a real understanding of the root causes of homelessness?
Yes. Let's put it this way. It might require that. Now, in my book, I don't offer a theory as to why there is homelessness, okay? I only look at the policy history and the administrative history and try to figure out, is the system being run well or not? Now, as to the question of why there is homelessness, I would say the dominant theory is what you might call a musical chairs theory. Number of affordable apartments goes down, number of poor people goes up, and some people just don't have a chair or an apartment, and they end up on the street. Now, I'm not sure if I agree with that theory, right? Because theoretically, if you're an economist and if you think like an economist, what ought to happen is if there are people on the street who have some kind of an income, and most people on the street do have some kind of an income, if only in the form of some kind of public assistance, well, then why don't people, take garages and basements and refurbish them and such? And as I say, we're talking about a relatively small population of only 60,000 relative to a housing stock of 3 million. Why exactly doesn't that happen? And I've never gotten been able to find a good answer to that. I mean, part of the problem is that many people on the street, they have all sorts of disabilities, which makes it very difficult for somebody to say, sure, come on in. So I don't know for a theory as to why there is homelessness.
So there was a theory at one point that when the mental hospitals started closing down, they were dumping people on the streets, and they had nowhere else to go.
Well, but you have to be sophisticated about this. Deinstitutionalization, in that sense, took place mostly in the 50s and up through the mid 60s. So, if you're talking about people who were once in a mental hospital and are now on the street, that's pretty much over with. You could talk about non-institutionalization in the sense of people who would have been institutionalized in the past but aren't. And now, however, we finally come up after a long period of searching with something like an alternative to the old upstate mental hospitals, which is supportive housing. So now, theoretically, we have a place to move mentally ill people to, and I think what we have to do is develop more supportive housing and move them in there.
My guest is Thomas J. Main, associate professor at the School of Public Affairs at Baruch College, City University of New York. His book, Homelessness in New York City, Policymaking from Koch to de Blasio. You break down the history of homelessness policy in New York City into three distinct phases.
Yes.
Entitlement, paternalistic, and post-paternalistic. Are these phases tied to specific years or administrations?
Yes. To Yes, they're tied to specific years and specific administrations. However, what I would say now is they've kind of been paternalism has been imposed on top of entitlement and post-paternalism on top of the other two. So now we've got a system that's kind of all three simultaneously. But entitlement, I would say, was a phase mostly through the Koch years. It started with the litigation of the Callahan versus Carey case, which was a case where the city and the state were sued. The claim was the city had an obligation under the state constitution to provide shelter for homeless men. A consent decree between the city and the plaintiffs resulted the Callahan consent decree, where the city basically said any homeless man who applies for shelter gets it. That right was extended to homeless women. And then later, Steve Banks, who is now commissioner of the Department of Social Services, he brought suit on behalf of homeless families in the McCain legislation. And so during the early 80s, you had the development of a series of mostly court-based rights to shelter. And that was the entitlement phase, which lasted up, I would say, until the end of the Dinkins administration.
Those cases brought largely by the Coalition for the Homeless?
Yes. Well, let's see.
There aren't too many homeless people in the Coalition for the Homeless.
Well, it was mostly a coalition for the homeless rather than a coalition of the homeless. Well, let's see. Callahan versus Carey. Bob Hayes was the leader in that suit. I don't recall off the top of my head if he was working at Legal Aid at the time. Steve Banks was working at Legal Aid. So Legal Aid was really behind the McCain litigation. Bob Hayes was behind the Callahan litigation.
So this was policy kind of imposed on the city by the courts.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. And I think, you know, in a conventional history of this of homeless policy, the argument is, the reason we got a right to shelter is because we had this institutional reform litigation. A right to shelter was established, and the city was dragged kicking and screaming to establish a right to shelter.
Is this unique to New York City? Has New York become the country's laboratory for dealing with homelessness over the past 35 years because we were the ones who had the court cases?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, for New York City's political culture, is not necessarily always a progressive, but it's usually activist, and we expect government to do something. There's that, and then there's in the state constitution, there's a language that could be interpreted as supporting a right to shelter, and I think that's how we ended up with something like a right to shelter here, but other cities don't have that.
And did the bureaucracy grow out of a response to court decisions rather than the way most city bureaucracies develop?
Well, of course, before the court decisions, we already had an extensive bureaucracy, welfare bureaucracy. But it expanded, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Were we dealing at all with these issues? Obviously not to the point where it wasn't felt necessary to go to court.
See, this was interesting. The city did offer shelter to homeless Bowery bums, so-called, right, before Callahan versus Carey.
There was a thing called the Muni, but the Bowery. But I spoke to a number of people at that time and there was a book called Bowery, in which people said they didn't like going to the Muni. It was really an awful place to stay.
The place I remember is the 8 East 3rd Street shelter.
There were religious shelters as well, but there you had to go through some religious ceremony, or else you weren't given shelter for the night.
The 8 East 3rd Street, which I went to, was quite bad and smelled terrible. But the point is, the city was doing something. So it was hard for the city to argue, for instance, in the case of homeless families, it's hard for them to say, yes, we're sheltering homeless individuals, but we're not going to shelter homeless families. And also it was hard for the city to argue we're going to provide shelter. Since they were providing shelter, the big issue became, should they provide high-quality shelter? And the answer to that had to be yes.
My guest is Thomas J. Main, who is an associate professor at the School of Public Affairs at Baruch College His book, Homelessness in New York City, Policymaking from Koch to de Blasio, is published by New York University Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Thomas J. Main, Associate Professor at the School of Public Affairs at Brooke College, City University of New York. His book, Homelessness in New York City, Policymaking from Koch to de Blasio, is published by New York University Press. And we mentioned earlier that homelessness policy has had three phases, although they've overlapped each other: entitlement, paternalistic, and post-paternalistic. Haven't these phases come with what you call perverse incentives?
Yes. Well, this was one of the issues that came up during the entitlement phase, which was through Koch and through most of the Dinkins administration. The question was this: if you say to people, come and ask for shelter and we'll give it to you, will this create an incentive for people to leave bad housing to get shelter, right? And this was a serious concern. If you took a look at the research on where homeless men were the night before they came into the New York City shelter system back in the early 80s, most of them were not on the streets. Most of them were in some form of bad housing, you know, institutions like a prison or whatever. So it was a serious concern. Gee, we want to make sure that the people who are in housing, it might be bad, and that's an issue, but we want to make sure they don't come into the shelter system. Then the issue of perverse incentives really broke open when Dinkins' administration started moving homeless families into refurbished apartments that the city owned. And then when they did that, they did that much more aggressively than Koch did, there was an uptick in the number of families coming into the system. So some people in the Dinkins administration, including Dinkins eventually, and also me, we came to the conclusion that, gee, a perverse incentive has been created. We're actually drawing more people into the system. We don't want that.
On the other hand, wouldn't that be preferable to some of the other solutions we had, which is putting people into these big dormitory-type spaces in the armories, or putting them in these SRO hotels that were charging the city a lot of money and providing very poor services?
Yes, possibly. But the real problem with perverse incentives is it turned out the perverse incentive was much weaker than anybody.
So people weren't really leaving their poor housing and taking advantage of it.
Here's the thing. Years later, the numbers were crunched. To attract one new family into the system, you have to place seven sheltered families into permanent housing. So that's a pretty weak incentive. That gives you can place a whole lot of people into housing without driving the census up.
So what does the fight for homelessness policy reveal about the political environment of New York City?
That's interesting.
Isn't a lot of this also political and based on political philosophies?
The big political mystery for me behind homeless policy was, here you had a very large shelter system, largest in the country certainly, $1 billion a year budget now, and it all developed, or mostly developed, under three pretty conservative mayors: Koch, Giuliani, and Bloomberg. The sole exception being Dinkins, who was a progressive. He was in for only one term. Isn't that odd that a right to shelter and expansion of the shelter system happened under a, you know, semi-permanent conservative governing coalition?
But usually with some strings attached. For example, during the Giuliani administration, weren't people also told that they had to find certain kinds of jobs, work sometimes at jobs that really were not the best kinds of work could have put them into?
Absolutely. And you put your finger on the second phase of a homeless policy.
This is a paternalist.
Paternalism. When Giuliani comes in, Giuliani says, hey, look, enough with – he didn't end the right to shelter. He said, okay, we're going to give you shelter, but in return, you got to participate in work or rehabilitation. There's going to be a quid pro quo. That was paternalism.
And the idea sounds fine until you look at some of the jobs that these people were forced to do.
Well, there's that consideration. The what turned out to be the problem with it was if you went to people who were mentally ill on the street and you said, okay, we'll give you permanent housing, but in return, you got to go into rehabilitation, you got to dry up and clean up. That sounds rational, but a lot of people said no. Mm-hmm. So the problem was you weren't making as much of a dent in the street homeless population as you wanted to. And eventually, the paternalist deal kind of got weakened, and the city started saying, look, before we ask you to rehabilitate, we're going to put you in permanent housing.
Now, let's go back a little while. FDR included housing as a right in his Economic Bill of Rights. Did that affect policy around the country?
Well, I don't know much about homeless or housing policy under the New Deal and post-war period. I know mostly about homeless policy. But yes, I think there was, you know, there was an expansion, an attempt to build more public housing under FDR and immediately in the post-war period. And that effort got scaled back pretty dramatically by the 1970s.
You quote someone describing the emergency assistance unit as one of the most disturbing places on earth. Yeah. What was the EAU and why was it so awful?
Yeah, the EAU was the – at one point there were several EAUs, but let me talk about the time when there was just one in the Bronx. It was the main intake point for – into the shelter system for homeless families. And the problem was the family would come in and very often no shelter was available. So they had to stay in the EAU for hours, days, for a very long time. And the EAU was just not able to accommodate them very well. You had people sleeping on the floor. You had dirty diapers all over the place. You had sour milk, screaming babies, screaming adults. So it was a very unpleasant environment.
Thomas J. Main's book is Homelessness in New York City, Policymaking from Koch to de Blasio. It's published by New York University Press. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the Koch administration's signature achievements was the creation of 150,000 housing units.
Yes.
Were any of them given to the homeless?
Yes. This was, I think, Koch, who I interviewed for the book before he passed away, took great pride in this effort to develop affordable housing. Only about 10% of it ended up going to the homeless. He was concerned that if a lot of it went to the very poor, the political support for it would disintegrate. But a substantial amount of it did go to the homeless, and that was quite an achievement.
One of the key figures in developing homeless policy is our current governor, Andrew Cuomo. What did he contribute, and would you consider him a policy entrepreneur, as
yes,
some have
I would
suggested.
Say. What happened was, as I described, we had an entitlement phase in homeless policy through Koch and under Dinkins. Then this concern of perverse incentives developed, and also people started saying, hey, we're giving people shelter, but they have obviously all sorts of problems. Shouldn't we address the mental health, the substance abuse problems? So for a while, Dinkins seemed confused about what to do. And he created, this is what confused politicians often do, create a blue ribbon panel to study the problem and come up with a recommendation. The panel was led by Andrew Cuomo. They published, after about a year, a document. It's called The Way Home, which basically enunciated the paternalist paradigm, which said, look, we're not going to abandon the right to shelter, but to get shelter, well, once we satisfy that right, you've got to do something in return.
Doesn't paternalism assume that there's something fundamentally wrong with the homeless that has to be fixed in order for them to be worthy of the housing?
Yeah, that's the assumption. I don't know if worthy would be the issue, but the assumption is if you're homeless, you're not homeless. You know, you're not just an average person. There must be something wrong with you. And therefore, in order to house you effectively, we got to deal with the underlying problem. Otherwise, you won't stay housed. That was the theory.
What was the structural effect of the paternalistic era and the shelter system under Giuliani? Weren't there more not-for-profit organizations taking responsibility for the homeless? The city was being relieved of some of its responsibility?
Well, this was an interesting story. You had a right to shelter, right, in the form of the Callahan versus Carey consent decree. You couldn't get out of that, okay? Now, here's the problem. If you're going to say, all right, we'll give you shelter, but you have to participate in rehabilitation, suppose somebody says no. Well, then you can't deny them the shelter under their right to shelter. So what do? You privatize or not-for-profitize the shelter system, and you say, yes, everybody gets shelter at a city-run shelter, but if you want to go to a nicer program shelter that will deal with whatever problem you have, then you've got to say, yes, I'll participate in the rehabilitation. And incidentally, that resulted in a dramatic improvement in the quality of the shelters for individuals.
And that was during the Giuliani administration.
Yes.
And then we get Bloomberg as the next mayor. He is responsible for what you call post-paternalism.
Yes. I tried to come up with a better name, but I couldn't think of it. The problem with paternalism was this. One, if you say, okay, the deal is you get shelter, but you got to rehabilitate, one problem is a lot of people say no.
And some can't.
Some can't rehabilitate. Yeah. The other problem is this. Suppose you say there's something wrong with you. That's why you're homeless. Therefore, we have to address what's wrong with you. Well, now when the person is in the shelter system, you're saying, I got to cure his alcoholism or his substance abuse before we can get him out of the system.
He's bipolar. He's paranoid.
Right.
He's schizophrenic.
Right. And so if you say, well, we got to deal with that before we can house you, then you've painted yourself into a corner. So that was a limitation. All of these paradigms had their limitations. Paternalism had its limitation. Bloomberg comes in. It's very fascinating. Here's a Republican billionaire mayor, and he goes way out on a limb, and he says, I'm going to try to end homelessness. That's very interesting. You know, people who say that politicians are always motivated by self-interest ought to think about that. I mean, why was it in the self-interest of Bloomberg to do that? It's not clear. Now, of course, in the end, he failed. But he had a lot of good ideas, like housing first.
But then in came de Blasio, who promised to correct the situation, and we still continue to have problems.
I think one of the things that happened is Bloomberg came in and tried to implement housing first and post-paternalism, but he also ended all forms of subsidies, rent subsidies, and transfer of families into public housing to try to reduce the shelter census.
And how did the housing first program work?
The Housing First program, this was for mentally ill homeless individuals. The deal was, instead of saying, hey, if you clean up, we'll give you housing, instead you say, you want housing? Permanent housing, not shelter, right? Permanent housing right now. If you say yes, you get it right now. And many more people took that up. And Housing First did result in a pretty dramatic decline in the number of mentally ill homeless people on the street.
Well, we don't see too many people sleeping on the streets. I still see some.
Yes.
But it's a lot less than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
I think that's right. I also think recent reports that street homelessness has exploded under a de Blasio, I don't think that's correct.
What is de Blasio's approach to this?
Well, when Bloomberg said, okay, no more subsidies, the shelter census shot up. And so the obvious thing to do was, hey, we got to start giving people rental subsidies and access to public housing to drive the shelter census down. And de Blasio has implemented a subsidy program. It's called several of them. They're called the LINC programs, Living in Community programs. And keep your fingers crossed. We have to hope they're going to kick in and work.
You say that the homeless almost unconsciously advocate for themselves simply by being visible.
Yes. Now, the homeless, you know, didn't advocate for themselves in the way that, let's say, working people did by forming unions. However, just by being visible, and that was kind of almost just like a kind of a silent or almost, you know, unselfconscious protest. However, beyond that, beyond their visual presence, the homeless never really mobilized as a self organized interest group in the way that working people did. The homeless rights were obtained mostly by the efforts of a policy network acting on behalf of the homeless.
WNYC ran a story a couple of days ago about how New York State has begun to invest Medicaid money into real estate to provide low-income housing as a creative way to lower medical costs for their users. Is that an example of policy entrepreneurship?
Well, policy entrepreneurship, it's kind of a term of art. What I mean by policy entrepreneurship is somebody who gets an idea. You know, hey, relatively simple idea. Hey, how about a right to shelter? Or, wait a minute, how about, you know, quid pro quo? You get something, but you got to give something back. So Hayes was the guy who came up with the idea of a right to shelter, and then the policy entrepreneur goes out and sells it in one way or another. And so I see the big policy entrepreneurs in New York City as having been Bob Hayes and Steve Banks. I see Andrew Cuomo and Giuliani as being the policy entrepreneurs behind paternalism. And I see...
Has Cuomo changed his position since we're talking about using Medicaid funds here?
Let's see. You know, it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what Cuomo wants to do about the homeless. I think the main thing Cuomo wants to do about the homeless is blame it all on de Blasio. So I can't get anybody at the state level to talk to me, so I really am not in a position to tell you what the heck he's doing.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's You're been welcome.
A fascinating conversation. My guest, Thomas J. Main, who is associate professor at the School of Public Affairs at Baruch College. His book, Homelessness in New York City, Policymaking from Koch to de Blasio, is published by New York University Press.
Thanks so much.